Logical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, the first talk in a series titled Historical Alternatives to Biblical Christianity, was presented by Ron Julian on January 9, 1996, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
This series is potentially very presumptuous, and I want to address that right off the bat here. We're looking at various historical alternatives to biblical Christianity. And who is it that's going to define what biblical Christianity is? Well, that's us. That's me, Jack, and some other folks here. So basically, one way of thinking about this class is... here are all the ways in which everybody else is wrong except us.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to say that sounds terrible, but you all seem to sort of like it. I think it's not as bad as it might sound. I think this is going to be a good class, but I want to explain to you what it is we're doing here. It seems to me that all of us have the responsibility to sort out what's true from what's false. I mean, this is just part of the human situation. We hear a lot of stuff, and we bear a certain responsibility for what we listen to. The fact is that Christianity as a historical, cultural phenomenon has had people saying all kinds of things. I mean, just about anything you can imagine on just about all of the topics that Christianity addresses, there have been a variety of perspectives on. So we really don't have a choice, it seems to me. We have to, at one point or another, face into all of those different voices and ask ourselves which of them is saying something true and which of them is saying something false. So the questions are, which of the differences that are out there today and have been there historically, which of those differences are important? Which are the ones that we really ought to be concerned that we get right? Why are they important? And what is, in fact, the truth about the issues that they address? So that's the kind of thing that we're going to be exploring in this class. We are going to assert a certain perspective on what biblical Christianity is and what it has to say about life. In fact, tonight, I'm going to just out and out assert this is what it looks like. And I hope that we're doing this in a spirit that is appropriate. We're certainly not saying that just because we say it's like this, that it is in fact like this. It may not be. You would be really foolish to believe it just because we say so. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily false because we say it either. I mean, what we want to do is get a certain perspective out there on the table and say, this is the perspective that makes sense to us. And if this perspective is anywhere close to what the Bible is teaching, then there are a series of variations on these themes that we find historically that it would be good to look at and address and try to understand. So we're going to be contrasting this perspective on what Christianity is with various voices that have said various things along the way. And what we're asking for you to do is to consider those places of conflict and at least, you know, hear out what we're saying about where the differences are and where they're important. But I know myself, I've been down this road for a long time and I've got a long ways to go, so I cannot believe that I'm not mistaken about at least something that I think, and maybe any number of things. So you'd really be foolish to believe it just because I say so. Now, Jack, that'd be different when he comes, but... yeah, see, now there's a good example. But we're just trying to put something out there for you to consider. This seems very important to me. The kinds of differences we're talking about seem to me to be important differences, and we want to try to spell out what we think they are and why they're important, and then you can take it where you think it needs to go. Tonight, my purpose is not to talk about any particular historical tradition or any particular historical issue. I'm not naming any names in what we're talking about tonight. As a prelude to that, my purpose is to just talk about the kinds of issues that we might confront as we look at some of the historical variations on what the Christian Church has taught at various times. What are some of the logical alternatives to biblical Christianity? That is, if biblical Christianity asserts certain things about reality, then what are some of the alternatives that we might find out there, and why might we find them? So that's what I'm going to talk about tonight. And in a way, what I'm doing, I picture as sort of giving a defense for the whole topic of this class in the first place. I mean, this is why taking on a study like this would be worthwhile. Okay, so let me see. I want to start, I said we're going to be asserting a certain perspective on what biblical Christianity is, and I want to start by just making that assertion up front. I want to paint a picture for you here. Some of you have been a part of the, have been a part of the class that's going on in the first hour, and some of the things that I'm going to say here I said in one of those classes last quarter, but it's going to be different some, and anyway, this is where we need to start. So I'm trying to step back here from too much theological jargon. I'm just trying to step back and say this is the picture, this is the big picture as the Bible would present it, if you kind of get the whole thing in focus, which is an audacious thing to take on, but I'll do it. Everyone has a philosophy of life. I mean, everyone, whether they've thought about it, articulated it or not, has a way of thinking about and dealing with the rest of the world that they live in. And it seems to me that it's helpful to think about our philosophy of life in terms of four areas that we deal with: God, our neighbor, ourself, and the world. These categories are going to, I'm going to be referring to this a lot here tonight. I have to define myself and understand myself in relationship, certainly, to everyone else in the world. Certainly, I have to figure out what I think about myself, who I am and what I'm about, and I have to figure out where I fit, how I relate to the rest of the world, the stuff around me, its importance to me. And all of us, I mean, even the staunchest atheist is really coming to some conclusion about God. Where does he fit into the picture, and how am I going to relate to him? One of the questions we could ask is, it would relate to how do I see the relative significance and importance of these things? If we were to talk about what is the most significant, what is the weightiest, what is that which is most important, most worthy of consideration, and so on, we might ask ourselves, how do these things relate to each other? The Bible, I think, is saying to us that how we think about the relative importance of these things is a very crucial thing. It's one of the most crucial things about me as a person, is how do I understand myself in relationship to these different areas and their relative importance to each other. If we had our heads and our hearts screwed on right, it seems to me that we would look at these four things like this. God, we would understand to be the most significant and important part of reality. He is the creator. He is all good. He is the ruler of all. He controls all of creation, but he also is ruler by rights. By rights, I ought to recognize his right to rule. I ought to be grateful for his having created me, and so on. If I understood things in their right perspective, then if I were to, I mean, this is going to look like a financial chart or something in a minute. I know it, but just that's you just have to bear with that. God gets the big, big piece here. Okay, this is going to work. You watch. Okay, so my neighbor, if I understood things rightly, I would see my neighbor as a creature of God, intrinsically worthy of honor and consideration because he is a creature of God, and essentially, I would understand him to be as significant a creature of God as I am. So my neighbor would come in here, and I don't know. The ratios are not going to be real good. I'm not worried about that. In fact, I was working with this charting program. I was going to do an overhead and everything with this, and I decided not to. But I couldn't get the numbers on the side to go away. So it was marking off these numbers. And I was thinking, now, how am I going to explain those numbers when I get here? I was trying to come up with a formula, but it wouldn't work. Okay. So, now, when it comes to myself, if I were thinking rightly about things, this little bar would be the same. I am not less significant than my neighbor, but I am not more significant than my neighbor either. I am a creature of God. I am worthy of honor and consideration because I am a creature of God. But I am not God, definitely, and I am no more important or significant than my neighbor is. And then finally, when it comes to the world is worthy of a certain consideration. It is a creation of God. It is something to be appreciated and enjoyed in an appropriate way. But the fact is that if I really understood things, if I saw things in perspective and understood where the most important things are, if I saw the values of God and understood what he was all about, I could take it or leave it. The world as it stands is not the focus of my existence, or it wouldn't be if I understood the way things are, especially in this age, especially coming to understand something of the gospel and what it is that God ultimately is going to do with this creation. The world as it stands now would be something that I was capable of enjoying, but I could also put it aside. Now, the fact is, the Bible tells us that we don't have our heads and our hearts screwed on right. This is reality. This is the way it is, but this is not the way we live. This is not the way our passions drive us. And I mean passions of every sort. My instincts as a human being, the things that I think and feel, and the things that went the way I react to the world around me is not in keeping with this, even though this is the way things really are. Instead, God, he gets, we'll put in kind of a dotted line there, because there are some of us who just push him out of the picture altogether. And then there are others of us who very generously give him a little blip on the screen over here. But basically, because of the selfishness of what the Bible calls our sin, God is a competitor. God is going to come along and tell me things about reality that I don't want to hear. He's going to tell me that things I want to do, I shouldn't do. He's going to tell me that things that I don't want to do, I should do. And since I am the measure of all things, and my own desires are of most interest to me, my major competitor has got to go. So that's the first thing. Now, when it comes to my neighbor, I might be able to get something from my neighbor, so we'll go up a little higher with him. But the fact is that one thing that has got to be clear, and here, let's put this, we're going to kind of darken this in. This is the other perspective. Okay, and we've got the neighbor here. What's crucial is I know it in my gut that my neighbor is not as important as I am. That's a settled question. I know that. We all know that. And I'm not talking about, you know, what I might say, you know, in a public forum talking about the homeless or something like that. I'm just talking about what happens when somebody bumps me at that forum and my initial reaction is, that was me that you did that to. I mean, if you had bumped him, that wouldn't have been a problem because then it wouldn't have been me. I mean, that's our reaction. That's how we think about it. And so, as is probably going to be obvious, when it comes over here to ourself, we are the most significant thing in creation. That is, I am the most significant thing in creation. Not all of us. I am. But to you, I mean, you are the most significant thing in creation. No, it's funny, but it is actually very tragic. Look at the world around you. Go out and just watch for a day what happens in the world, and you'll see that the reason it's going that way is because although reality is like that, the way we think about things is like this. And the world, it actually gets bumped up there pretty good. Because the world is not my competitor. The world is my potential best friend. If I'm looking to take care of my desires and meet my needs, what better shot have I got than the stuff around me? I mean, I might be able to make something of this. And we kid ourselves that we might be able to take this and somehow turn it into something that's really going to do something for us. And so the world gets elevated in our thinking beyond what it can bear. Okay. This is, you know, just in a very brief little picture is my understanding of the warped nature of human thinking, our reaction to life and how we act. Now, this is a problem in two ways. That is, there are two ways in which we're warped that we can emphasize here. This is the way I act. If you were to watch and see how I behave, this is the way I relate to the world around me. I mean, my interests predominating and God taking a minor back seat and my neighbor taking a back seat to my interests and an inappropriately large interest in the world and its treasures. That's kind of where we're coming from. So this represents, you know, the chart of our actual attitudes as they're reflected in our behavior. But there's another problem that goes along with that. And this is a serious problem as well. If I want to preserve this, because this, I feel like this is my best shot at taking care of me, making sure that I get what I want. But I also want to feel justified. I want to feel like I'm okay. I don't want to think of myself as someone who is flying in the face of reality. So if I were to admit that reality is really like the little white bars here, then I would have this great incongruity between the way I'm living and operating and the way I actually think things are. So not only do our desires drive us to act in a certain way, but they drive us to think about reality in a certain way. That is, we want to preserve the idea that things really are kind of like this. We want reality to be that way. And so, in order to justify ourselves, we become an enemy of the truth. There are certain truths, predominantly, I mean, where's the biggest gap here? Is between where God ought to be and where he is in our thinking. So this is the one that we want to stay away from as much as possible. We want to hide from the reality of who God really is and what he deserves in our thinking and our attitudes. So we have these two problems. We're evil, but it's more than just evil. We are also liars. We're stupid. We have made ourselves stupid because there are certain crucially important truths that we will not know. And that's, I mean, that's as stupid as you can be. To deliberately stay away from the truth is, I mean, that's, you're never going to get anywhere doing that. I mean, you can keep shuffling the deck as much as you want, but if you took out all of the face cards, you're just never really going to get anywhere. And that's what we're doing. We took out all the face cards, and now we're trying to end up with a royal flush somehow, and it's just not going to work. Okay, so now I got one more piece now. We talked about the problem being the evil, the perversion of our relation to reality. We have warped and distorted what reality really is, and we don't want to know any different. We want to think about the world in the way that's going to be comfortable to us. So we're in really bad shape because, first of all, being like this, being warped sinners in our perspective, we are suffering in this world. Sinners end up being frustrated and dying. I mean, the fact is that sin is robbing us of life. What life could be, it is not, because we're sinners. As much as we're trying to take care of number one, in fact, we are destroying ourselves with it. So what life ought to be, what life could be, it is not, because of our sin. So that's our first problem. I mean, we're trying to take care of ourselves, but we're doing a terrible job of it. We're, in fact, destroying ourselves. Our second problem is, who could save us from this? Who could give us this life that we are robbing from ourselves with our sin? God could do that. But why would He want to? Because we're sinners. Not only are we destroying ourselves with our sin, but we are guilty before our righteous God because of our sin. So, I'm hurt and I'm guilty. Well, maybe God could do something to take care of the problem of my guilt. Maybe He, and in fact, what the gospel tells us is He has. In the cross of Christ, He's done something to take care of my guilt. But who does that cross apply to? How do you become one of those people that is actually forgiven because of your sins? Well, the Bible says you believe. But I want to assert right now that what we're talking about when we're talking about believing in the Bible is, what we're talking about is acknowledging the truth. Instead of turning from the truth as an enemy, we embrace it and say, yeah, that's right. This is where God belongs. This is where my neighbor belongs. This is where I belong. This is where the world belongs. And I am screwed up because instead of thinking and acting that way, I'm doing it this way. It's the person who acknowledges that truth that is the believer, the one who comes to be justified, to be forgiven for his or her guilt. But remember what I was saying before. We have this other problem. Not only are we like this, but we hate the truth that would tell us otherwise. And Jesus said that a number of times to the Pharisees, to those who wouldn't listen to Him. He said, the world hates me because I convicted of its sin, and that sort of thing. I mean, the fact is that the message of the gospel is not a particularly wonderful message of salvation until you get over your intense hatred of a message that would convict you of being that kind of person. So our problem is threefold. Life is bad because of sin. It can't become good until God forgives us. But God only forgives those who are in some way His friends instead of His enemies. That is, those who have accepted the truth of what the gospel is saying. Now, I don't want to give the wrong impression there. I'm not saying that we earn God's approval by believing what He said. That's not it at all. But the fact is that it is those who have a heart that welcome the truth of the gospel instead of turn away from it, those are the ones who are saved. So the story of the gospel then is the story of how God has reached out to save His people by, first of all, softening their hearts to the truth so that instead of turning from him in hatred and suspicion and unbelief, they respond to his promises and his commands with approval, with recognition, with welcome. Being that sort of person then, I come to know myself as one of those who is forgiven, for whom the blood of Christ is going to bring me, and is in fact bringing me justification, is making me right with God. I am not guilty in spite of the fact that I'm a sinner. And not being guilty then means that God is going to shower me with his blessings, which was his purpose to begin with. But what are the blessings of God? What is he going to shower me with? He's going to shower me with his blessings by solving the problem of sin that is destroying my life in the first place. So, God turns me from being a rebel to being a believer. As a believer, I am welcomed in to his family of children. And as a part of his family, I stand then to inherit the promise of his righteous kingdom, which is coming one day where life will finally be what life is meant to be. That's the biblical picture of life as I understand it. That we have this problem and that we're warped in this way, and that there are three aspects to what God needs to do for us. First of all, he needs to bring us to the point where we can see it, that indeed this is the way it is. And we can admit that we're in trouble and gratefully turn to him for the solution. He needs to provide the means to solve our guilt, make us acceptable before him, which is what he did with Jesus on the cross. And finally, he needs to solve this problem so that we're not like this anymore. And that's his promise. That's, in the end, that's what our hope is that in God's kingdom of righteousness, we will be finally what alone will truly satisfy. We will be truly alive, living life the way it ought to be. Okay, so why did I say all this? One thing I want to emphasize here is perhaps there's a couple of those pieces that may sound a little bit different to the way you might hear somebody describe what the gospel is all about. In particular, notice, I'm not really saying that it's believing in Jesus that marks you as one of those people who's going to get justified. What I'm saying is, you are a person whose heart has been turned from a hatred of the truth about these things in its various manifestations. A heart which is learning the truth about God, willing to learn that truth, who's learning the truth about the importance of his neighbor, who's learning the truth about the relative place that each of us has in the scheme of things, that we're not God and we're not more important than our neighbor. And to learn to recognize that the world, in terms of importance and value, pales in comparison with any of the things having to do with God, his values, his character, his promises, and so on. It's the person who has a heart that can acknowledge and believe those things, that is the person who is, in the end, going to be justified and enter into the kingdom of God. And that other piece is that the blessing that God has for his people should be described primarily in terms of a kingdom of righteousness that we will enter into one day. So, two of the areas where there are a lot of variations in Christian teaching are on what is it that defines you as a believer? What does it mean to be a believer? Who are the ones who get saved? And what is salvation? What is it that I'm going to God for? What is it that I'm, in the end, what do I want from him? So, those are, in particular, two areas that are going to be coming up a lot throughout this class as we're looking at some of the different perspectives on various issues that have happened historically is that a lot of times those issues are related to who is the one who is saved, what does it look like, and what is salvation all about in the end. Now, there are other questions as well, but those are kind of crucially important. Now, with that as a model, and I hope it's clear, but if it's not, I hope it will become clearer as we go along tonight and in the class. With that as a model, let me then propose a few what we'll call logical alternatives to that view. I mean, where are places that we could depart as we look at this model? Now, right up front, I want to say what we're talking about are, quote, Christian alternatives, in the sense that each one of these possibilities would label itself as being Christian because it would point to the Bible and say, see, here in the Bible, here's justification for X, Y, and Z. We're not talking about atheism obviously atheism is a logical alternative to all of this. God doesn't exist, and so what in the world are you talking about? I mean, that's a logical alternative, but that's too far removed from what our purposes are here. That's not what we're addressing. But those perspectives that would turn to the Bible and say, see, Jesus would say, and argue for a particular way of looking at life, those are the ones that we're concerned with. Here's the place for me to say that as we start to talk about a few of these possibilities, the question we're going to be looking at is, how significant are these differences and alternatives? I mean, what difference does it make? Okay, so on some question, somebody takes a theological left turn instead of a theological right turn, or vice versa. Who cares? I mean, in the end, is God deeply concerned that everybody have all of their doctrinal I's dotted and T's crossed and so on? That's not what we're saying, and that's not why we're doing this class. See, you can understand, because we are the kind of self-centered and fairly short-sighted people that we are, the best of us are, you can see how it would be easy to make intellectual mistakes just through not having thought it through enough, through being sloppy, through being lazy, through having a particular favorite way of thinking about things that you just weren't quite ready to throw out yet. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we can end up going wrong. And all of us do. So being wrong about some particular theological issue in and of itself, I would argue, it's not the end of the world. I mean, all of us are going to go through it, and we're going to progress in our understanding, hopefully. But you can see with this model, I'm suggesting that it's crucially important that one of the fundamental issues that I have to confront in my life, that each of us has to confront, is whether we are going to embrace the truth about this. That is, whether I am willing to see God for who He is and see myself for who I am. That means see myself and my relative importance in the scale of things, but also see myself as one who has deeply perverted the truth and followed after what is wrong instead of what is right. So having a heart that can look at the cross and say, yeah, I can see why Jesus would have had to die, because I'm guilty. I'm not in the right at all. I'm in the wrong. Having that kind of disposition to the truth, that's what our journey through this life is all about. That's the thing that's going to separate the sheep and the goats in the end, is how we respond to these somewhat unpleasant truths in some ways about who God is and who we are and so on. Our theology, the things that we are willing to believe and embrace as true, sometimes has a fairly straightforward connection between what we are in fact willing to embrace and believe. So I am quite convinced that on most theological issues that I have come across, that there are kind of two ways to go wrong. There's that sort of immaturity of thinking that leads you to just go down the wrong road because you just frankly can't do any better at that spot. But there's a certain innocence to that, in that over time and the God's leading us into wisdom, taking us through trials that kind of sort things out for us, we start to get a handle on what's important and what's true and what's right. There's another way, though, to go theologically wrong, and that is, it is a theology that reflects a heart that is basically in rebellion against these truths in one way or another. A heart that will not acknowledge that this is my relative importance in the scheme of things, or a heart that will not acknowledge that the world and its treasures is really not all that big a deal, or a heart that will not acknowledge that God has as big a place in the universe as he in fact does. And that, in that way, theology then becomes a kind of a touchstone for our hearts, a reflection of our hearts. That's why in certain places in the Bible, theology is pushed so crucially. Why Paul in Galatians, which we'll talk about next week, can say something like, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. I mean, what he's saying is, to make a mistake here is your life, your eternal destiny is at stake. Why? Because of a petty little argument about how you ought to understand a provision in the Mosaic Law? No, it's because of the attitude that was being reflected by those who embraced the teaching about circumcision. What they were unwilling to acknowledge about themselves and about God. And we'll talk about that some. So, when we talk about the different ways in which one might depart from what the Bible has to say about reality, it's not that being wrong is always the road straight to hell, but it's crucially important that we as people come to terms ourselves with these issues. Is it in fact true that doctrine that I just will not embrace, even though it's clear that the Bible teaches it, why won't I? What is it about it that pushes me away? Maybe it's because in the end, I don't really want to acknowledge that I'm a sinner. I don't believe it. Or maybe in the end, it's that I really don't think that there's anyone in the universe more important than I am. And I'm not willing to acknowledge that that could ever be the case. That's what can happen. Okay, so here's what I want to do. I want to take some issues, some things that the Bible says that have relationship to the things that we're just talking about here, and show how they could theoretically go wrong. I'm not attaching these to any particular labels or historical movements. We're just kind of going to look at some examples of how the model of biblical Christianity that I'm talking about here could be distorted and how that might be significant. Let's start with the idea of belief. We can rightly point to the Bible as saying that believing in Jesus, believing the gospel, is somehow central to this issue of salvation. We can see places in Romans where Paul is arguing clearly that believing in Jesus is what marks those who are accepted by God, and it's the fact that the Jews that he's arguing against will not believe in Jesus that clearly marks them as those who are not justified before God. I mean, so belief clearly is an issue. If the perspective that I have been arguing for is right, then why is belief an issue? Belief in the promises of God, in the story about Jesus, is a reflection of a heart that is newly willing to accept the truths that we see reflected up here. That is, I mean, first of all, obviously, you have to be willing to accept the truth about God, that He is there, that He is as good as He is, and so on. I have to be willing to recognize the importance of my neighbor and the relative importance of myself and the things in the world, because in order for the gospel to make any sense to me, I have to be willing to recognize that I have been living totally out of kilter. I have been living totally out of sync with the way things really are. I have been a rebel against what is true and right. I'm selfish, I'm greedy, I'm impatient, I'm untrusting of God, and so on. That's why the gospel makes sense. That's why the story about the cross makes sense, is because that's what a person like me would need. The gospel promises me an eternity of living in God's righteous kingdom. Well, why would that even be interesting to me? Why would I care about a story about something like that if I weren't at bottom willing to recognize that I have greatly distorted the importance of the world that I am living in, and that in fact it is the things of God that are much more important than whatever I might be able to, whatever deal I might be able to make for myself in this age. If at bottom I'm not willing to come to terms with that, then the gospel is really not going to make any sense to me. So I would argue that belief in and of itself, you know, here's the story. Do you believe it? Sure. That transaction is of no significance. What's of significance is this newly found willingness to embrace the truths that are found in the gospel, where before I would have turned and run from them. That's what's significant. We see it, I would argue, in the New Testament. For example, in the book of Galatians, where there are people there who are being described who believe the story of the gospel. They believe that Jesus is the Messiah. They believe that he rose from the dead. But Paul calls them accursed. And the reason he does is because there's a part of this picture that they're not buying. Yeah, they believe the Jesus part with, you know, the Messiah and all of that. But when it comes right down to it, there's something about this that is totally unchanged in their attitudes. They have bought into the lie just as big as they ever did. That's why belief is significant, is that when it reflects that change, it shows, it's a sign that this change has really happened. But is it possible to believe without having had any of that change happen? Yeah. So you can see then where, logically speaking, one might go wrong. You could take the teaching on belief in the Bible and push it beyond what it was meant to do. Basically say, well, there are a couple of things you might say. One of the things you might say is the way to salvation. You need to have all your doctrines in order. That's clearly what the Bible is teaching. I mean, you know, you look in Galatians and Romans and they're getting their doctrine wrong. And you look in 1 John and they've got wrong doctrines about Jesus. You know, you got to believe that Jesus came in the flesh. And the Colossians, they're having doctrinal problems. And obviously, getting your doctrine right is the way to get saved. But you can see how, on the one hand, that might just be kind of an easy enough mistake to make, just kind of misreading what the Bible is suggesting and just misunderstanding what the significance of those passages is. But you can see how an assertion that says, getting your doctrine right, that's how you get saved, could in fact be a reflection of a totally unregenerate heart, a heart that is really just as worldly as anyone else's. Because in the first place, and I think you probably have had experience with something like this, but oftentimes those who assert that it's getting your doctrines right that is what's going to save you have a kind of a self-righteousness and pride that goes along with that, because what they basically mean is, I got mine right, that's why God is so pleased with me, and obviously he couldn't be pleased with you because you don't have it as together as much as I do. So if you would join me in believing all the right things, then you could be as acceptable to God as I am. And if you think that sounds like an exaggeration, then I think you're fortunate, because I've met too many people who basically were saying that very thing and didn't know it. but that's what they were saying. And at the same time, you can see how, in a way, that kind of view can very much diminish God. I mean, your God doesn't have to be very big in order for you to be able to fill out the true-false test and get all the answers right. I mean, you can do that, and God still is basically, as far as you're concerned, someone that you really don't want to come along and mess with your life. I mean, look, I got all the answers right about you, so leave me alone. I mean, and that, I mean, again, that's a realistic picture, I think. Roger, did you have your hand up?
What would you say to people who would say, Ron, you're making it too complicated. I mean, all you have to do is believe in your heart and confess with your mouth that Jesus Christ is Lord, and you will be saved.
Well, I guess I'd say that I'm not making it too complicated. They're making it too simple. I mean, one of us is... you can't... I mean, there's a sense in which if a guy was to stand up in medical school in the lecture on brain surgery and say, you're making it too complicated, I would want to make sure that I didn't go to him when I needed my brain repaired. I mean, the fact is that there is a certain amount of complexity to this. I mean, I bring this up a lot, but I mean, we can remember in 2 Peter where Peter makes the comment about Paul's letters that they're difficult to understand. I mean, I think that's just true, and I don't think that we really need to apologize for that. Now, having said that, there is a sense in which I can understand the spirit of that question, because I'm not saying you have to be able to articulate all of this to be saved. But what I'm saying is, yeah, it is simple. But it's not just believe it, because there are bad reasons to believe and there are good reasons to believe. What I would say is simple is, just from your heart, welcome and accept the truths of God through the regenerating power of the Holy Spirit. That's simple, but the implications of that as we go through our lives are complicated enough that we could talk about it forever. I mean, we can keep going back to the Bible and trying to refine our picture because there are a lot of different aspects to it. Yeah.
In James, in that scripture in there where it says that even the demons believe.
Right.
And they shudder.
Right.
And I've thought about that a lot, and of course, that book of James, especially in the first part there, is talking about loving your neighbor, loving your brothers and sisters, and so on and so forth. It seems to me that there, as well as throughout Scripture, we believe, we are given the faith to believe. But obviously, if we're given the faith to believe, there's going to be the works that follow. There's going
right.
to be certain things, and there's going to be certain moral character that comes out of that. Now, we're not going to be perfect. We're going to be obviously constantly learning, and it's going to be a constant process, falling down and getting up and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. I mean, the passage that in James... you believe that God is one, you do well, even the demons believe and shudder, is very relevant to right what I'm talking about here, because that's what James is saying, essentially, is, I would paraphrase what he's saying is, look, the demons are orthodox. I mean, they know the right answers. It's not a question of, I mean, right? But what, so he's saying, what good, in, if even the demons can be orthodox, then in the end, how good is being orthodox? I mean, what have you really accomplished by doing that? You got the right answer. But see, the thing about the demons is they know the right answer, but they don't welcome it. They want the answer to be something different than the answer that they know that it is. That's what I'm saying is, what characterizes the believer in this age is, in spite of our sin and our struggle with our own moral failures, is that we are not like the demons, and that when we hear the right answer, we don't say, I wish it were something different. We say, no, that's it. That's what I want. And that, it's that that, see, the faith then is a coming out of something, and as you say, that's going to go somewhere. I mean, the way I live is going to be different because my values and beliefs are different. Okay, but you see, what I'm trying to say here is here's one particular area, the issue of believing, where there are different theological perspectives. What role does belief play in salvation? Well, I'm saying it plays a role, and the Bible gives it that role because of the importance of this change of heart that marks the people of God. But others might want to argue that no, it's doctrinal purity in and of itself that is the mark, such that I can tell whether you're saved or not by whether you've got it right, which is to say whether you agree with me. Now, there's another way that this can go. It's kind of it's the same thing on the other side. Yes, the Bible emphasizes that you are saved by belief, but we're not talking about doctrinal purity and this big, you know, having all these things together. I'm just saying, look, here it is. Jesus died for your sins. You believe that? Yes, you're in. There it is. Again, it's emphasizing the idea that because the Bible talks about the connection between belief and being saved, that's it. That's all it takes, is just believe this story and you're in. And again, I would argue that that's an error. It's a serious error in understanding what faith looks like. What's the seriousness of that error as a doctrinal error? Well, it depends. For some people, I think it really just is, I think it's an intellectual mistake. They have misconstrued the biblical evidence. But there's a thing that can happen when you de-emphasize the full nature of what a regenerate believer looks like. And that is, if all it takes is it's just, okay, I'm going to believe and now I'm in, what do I do with all the rest of the stuff in the Bible that talks about obedience and faith and repentance and forgiveness and all of that? Well, okay, I'm forgiven, so I'm in the door. God did his part. I guess it's kind of up to me to get in there and do the rest. And there is a version of that kind of faith teaching that says, hey, just believe and you're in, that basically from then on would say, now where you get from there on is up to you. And you can see how potentially that's just kind of bringing God right down and pushing me right up along. So, as a doctrinal error, it could be personally relatively insignificant or personally absolutely determinative of where it is. It absolutely nails me and shows where my heart really is. What about obedience? Obeying God. The Bible talks about obeying God. It talks about salvation in connection with obeying God. So it would be appropriate to say that there is some sense in which obedience is required of the child of God. And that's right. Now, I would say that if we were to understand that biblical teaching, again, obedience in this life is a reflection not of my moral purity, not of the fact that I'm not a sinner anymore, but it is a reflection of this new heart that has accepted the truth about God and himself and the world and so on. If I have come to see something of who God is and welcomed it, and if I've come to see something of who I am and repented of it, and seen something of the relative insignificance of the world in comparison with the promises of God, then I am not going to live the same way. And this is what Gordon was referring to earlier, that the works that flow out of faith, it's not works that show my perfection, but it's works that show that in fact I have new values and beliefs because in fact I do. So obedience, rightly understood, becomes again a reflection of my this new heart for God. But there's a wrong way of understanding the role of obedience, and legalism is an example of this, which we'll be talking about next week. The idea that the Bible is calling me to obey, so that must mean somehow that I can obey in such a way that God will be pleased and accept me on the basis of my obedience. And that's kind of an attractive idea, because I always have kind of thought pretty well of myself, and I'm glad that God has recognized that He could set me a number of tasks and I could do them. And when they were done, He could pat me on the back and say, I knew you could do it, because I always knew I could do it. So, and you can see, I mean, the danger there, the denial of reality, the bringing down of the standards of God, sort of shrinking God down and say, after all, He only really wants this much. And that inflation of my own sense of what I am and what I can accomplish and what I deserve. I mean, that's the classic problem of legalism, is the inflated view of the self that is associated with it, together with, of course, the self-righteousness that goes along with it, that says, again, it's like I was saying about the doctrines. Look, I ate the right stuff, I said the right prayers, I went to the right services, why couldn't you do that? You could have done that and be as good as I am, but you didn't. And so I'm better than you are. I mean, I can just feel it. I know it. So again, how bad an error is it to put the wrong sort of emphasis on obedience, to actually suggest that I am obeying God in such a way that I really have done what is right and proper and earned my salvation with Him? Well, it's bad. I mean, it's pretty bad. This is one of the ones that the Bible hits really hard. But even there, I think there's a difference between kind of the immaturity that would just say, well, God, He said all that stuff to do, so I guess that's what we're supposed to do, and if I've done it, I guess I've done what I'm supposed to do, so all right. I mean, that kind of confusion in comparison with that heart of the Pharisee that basically welcomes a message that says, here's the list, do it, and you're in. And, you know, just that thing that responds and says, oh yeah, I can do this. That's the heart of unbelief, is that eagerness to accept that lie, yeah, I can do this, and that unwillingness to embrace the unpleasant truth about myself. Okay, this next one I could describe under the topic, we call it abundant life. I took this phrase because we were talking about this on the radio the other night. Jesus says, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. And I'm just using that as a place to kind of lump together all of the stuff that you might have heard over the years, throughout the ages, and on your television sets about how God's purpose in sending Jesus was basically so that you could not be sick and have success and money and health and happiness and obedient, believing kids who are going to join you in heaven and make you a lot of money on the way, and I mean the whole bit. You can see how there is a right understanding that is fueling that. The Bible does talk about God loving us and about God showering us with His blessings. And there's that language. Jesus, you know, I came that they might have life and have it abundantly. So clearly, we are not supposed to be thinking about God as somehow being stingy. And saying, boy, I really hate these little creeps, but I did tell them that I was going to save them. But man, just, you know, I got it in my pocket and just try to get it out. I mean, sometimes we kind of get that idea about God, I think, but clearly we're being told that's not the way it is. That's not the way God deals with His people. I mean, Jesus uses that picture, you know, of shaken down, pressed together. I mean, God's blessings are, it's like, no, come on, we can get more in there. Let's shake this thing down. There's room for more for Him. And that, we just run with that. I mean, many people throughout history have run with that idea and said, okay, shaken down, pressed together. I understand that. So, and I know, I see my pot, I know what I want to have in it, so it makes, I know exactly how this is going to work. And then, you know, the whole deal, here's the techniques for getting God to do it and so on. You can see how there's potential. I mean, as a doctrinal error, it might just be, I mean, our natural sinfulness and naivete and so on just kind of kicking in, and that can be the case. But you can see how it could be, in fact, a denial of one of the fundamental pieces that we're being asked to buy into here. I mean, Jesus said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness." But instead, we may be talking about a teaching that is absolutely welcome to the heart of someone who basically puts the world and its pleasures and treasures up here. And the rest of God's stuff can really, it's not all that interesting. So you can see the logically, it's quite possible that you could go in that direction, and many people have. And potentially, it's incredibly dangerous. Now let's talk about something different. Social justice. We can rightly point in the Bible to, we can look at the message of the prophets, and there are many, the many times that they spoke out against mistreatment of the poor and injustice and so on. And you can understand how there's many ways in which you, a concern for justice in a society could reflect very well all of these things. The neighbor becoming more important in my own estimation. God and his values becoming important. The self lowering down to a more reasonable perspective and seeing the things of this world in terms of my willingness to share them and be generous and not begrudge those who don't have as much and so on. I mean, that all could make a great deal of sense, and it does. And the Bible paints us a picture of the appropriateness of generosity, the appropriateness of justice in social settings, and so on. But again, there can be, you can understand how it could happen, that the idea of social justice could come to predominate over all the rest. The idea of our ultimate problem being a moral one, that the God's kingdom of righteousness is the ultimate answer to the human dilemma. I can push all of that aside and welcome the Bible's teaching on social justice because it fits the way I would like my world to be. I mean, it basically comes down to this world that I am counting on so much is going to pay off for me and everybody else a lot better if the world were if society were just instead of unjust. And it can be, and in fact, I think we could point to examples of places where social justice in, quote, Christian thinking has come to overwhelm the picture so much that there isn't really any room for God anymore. God isn't really hardly even there, except as sort of a prop to hold up our picture of social justice. How wrong an error is it to go in that direction? Well, again, it all depends. Where's it coming from? Is it coming from, you know, I was raised in a certain kind of political tradition and I just haven't sorted it all out? Or is it coming from the fact that in the end I am basically a fundamentally worldly person? That a message about making this world better really rings true to me because no other message would be interesting to me. We got started kind of late tonight and we're come to the end of our time and I'm not done. So let me think what to do here. Let me make a couple of last comments and then I'll open it up for your questions. questions, which we don't have time for. All right. Some other things I was going to mention. We could take something like worship, the worship of God. Hey, that's a great thing. And understanding it rightly, the biblical concept of worship in terms of submission to God as sovereign and gratitude towards God and so on, all of that, that's a right and a biblical thing. But you can understand how it could reflect a very worldly preoccupation, a desire for religious sensations today, and that same sort of legalistic mindset that says basically because I'm doing the worshiping right, God likes me, and he doesn't like you because you're doing it a different way or you're not doing it at all. We think about a personal relationship with God. There's a right emphasis that we could draw from the Bible that God is a person and that he cares for me. And I mean, it's right to point to language from the epistles like, you know, cast all your anxieties upon him because he cares for you and that sort of thing. That's right. And it would be wrong to deny that. But there's a way in which an emphasis on personal relationship with God can actually become perverted and unbelieving. It can become a doctrine that, again, it emphasizes my place in the world now. What I really want, the only thing that would be interesting to me from God, is to have him come along and make me feel better. And what would make me feel really good is to have a big cosmic friend who's going to help me all the time and make me feel good. Well, there's a part of that that's right, but there part of what it means to accept this picture is the recognition that God is trustworthy and that he knows what he's doing. And what believers of all ages have seemed to have universally found, at least it seems to, that way to me and what I see, is that there are those times when God takes us through the valley of the shadow of death. And far from being a close and loving companion, he seems like an incredibly hard taskmaster because that's where we are. Well, part of the heart of faith is understanding that God is to be trusted at those times. And so the doctrine of, you know, Christianity that emphasizes you can tell whether you're in fellowship, whether you're in good with God as to how close you're feeling to him at the moment, it can in fact promote a kind of a worldliness that is exactly the opposite of what it is we're really true belief looks like. Human freedom and God's sovereignty, both of those issues are big issues in doctrinal debates that have happened in the church. You can understand how, on the one hand, human freedom does need to be emphasized because it is in fact true. I have to choose. I have to face into the question, what do I want? What is my life about? Do I believe the gospel? Do I want what God has promised? And yet, there is a perverted kind of emphasis on human freedom that despises the idea of God's sovereign control over creation and basically wants to deny that God is the creator and that I'm the creature. And so there can be a rejection, an emphasis on human freedom that is essentially shaking your fist at God and saying, I wouldn't want to have anything to do with you if you were like that. And unfortunately, he is like that. On the other hand, God's sovereignty, God's control over all things, I think is right in a biblical doctrine. But at the same time, it is possible to take the doctrine of God's sovereignty and use it to put together a doctrinal picture that essentially denies human responsibility, that basically denies that I have anything to do. Now, this is a real tricky topic. We could talk all night about the ins and outs of this. But what I'm saying is there is a way of putting the picture of God's sovereignty together in such a way that it basically becomes good news to someone because, oh yeah, I always wanted to have a message that said, I don't have to do anything or think about it. Well, that's not the way this is working. I mean, the people who don't care anything about it and don't think about it are the ones who in the end don't get there. So that can be a total perversion. Well, the point here is, I obviously can't pretend to have exhaustively described all of the different avenues that Christian theology might take a wrong direction. But what I've tried to do is show you the kinds of things that can happen, that have happened, and suggest what I think is really at the heart of the issue. And that is that Christian faith, what we mean by saving faith, is an outworking of a change of heart. We believe because we now are willing to humbly admit that we're sinners and that we are not the center of the universe. We believe because we trust God, even though by nature we are the kinds of people who are suspicious of God and would like to eliminate Him from the picture altogether, and so on. That's what's at the heart of this. Each of us is playing this out in our lives. We are either, in fact, operating out of hearts like that, and that comes out over time in the way we believe and the way we act, or we're not. Our doctrines, the doctrines that the church has put forward, it seems to me, may be a reflection of a spiritual disease. And that's really why we're concerned about it. I mean, this is not... I mean, because I'm a person who spends a lot of time studying the Bible, and I really do like this stuff, and I really do care about it, I've thought about this a lot. You know, there are the classes. You know, you're in a class, elementary school or something like that, and there's that person who, whenever anybody made a mistake, they always threw their hand up and said, "That's not right. That was me." That was the kind of person that I was. That wasn't what I was going to say, actually. But that's right. That's right. But see, the reason I say that is that I want to make it clear that that's not why we're doing this. That's not what this is about. It's not like, you know, you get brownie points if you get the right answer or something. That's not what we're talking about. But I am convinced, in my life I have seen it, I've seen it in the lives of others, that these doctrines that we interact with when we look at the Bible are sometimes a part of those trials that God takes us through that is sorting us out. I mean, a lot of times, I mean, the more significant trials in our lives are, you know, I'm out there, somebody important dies, or I really want something and I didn't get it, or... you know, a relationship goes bad and I really wanted it to go well and all of that. I mean, those are the places where we really get hit hard. But sometimes where we get hit hard is in our doctrine. Something comes along and all of a sudden you're looking at it and you realize, it sounds like the Bible is saying that. How could that be? And you're at this spot where you're wrestling with, what am I going to do with this? Where is this going to take me in the end? That's why we're talking about this kind of stuff, is that the ways in which the church has, I think, departed from biblical Christianity at times. I mean, we're not talking about those historical times that the church has gotten it right, which we could point to as well. I mean, there are some things along the way that are tremendous and have greatly benefited our thinking over the years, I think. But we're concentrating on these places where we think that it's gone wrong. The reason it's helpful, I think, is because it gives us a chance to confront some of these fundamental issues as they work themselves out in various ways and basically ask ourselves, where do I sit in relationship to this? Is this in fact true? And if so, what am I going to do about it? So... That's what we're trying to do. And that's what I... So there was my defense for why we're doing this in the first place. And next week, we'll start talking about the problem of legalism in Galatians. So we're starting with a historical problem that the church had that you actually find in the Bible itself. But as we go along, we're going to be moving along and talking about things that are outside the Bible. I'm sorry I didn't leave really any time for questions. Is there a really burning question or any comment? We could take it, but we should probably stop. Okay, well...